Now, back to the Kim Pagano Show. Finally. On News Talk 1520 KVTA.
Welcome back, everyone, and I thank you so much. I hope you're having an amazing day, and I appreciate you for taking some time out of your day to listen to the Kim Pagano Show. I am your host, Kim Pagano, and today we are talking about how to nourish your mind, your body, and your soul, and how different foods trigger different memories. Right now, our next guest is going to be Barbara Magro, and she is on the line with us, and Barbara has actually written a book. Her book is Recipes to Remember, and it is a chronicle of a mother and daughter culinary journey through the devastating effects of Alzheimer's, a disease, on her family. And like so many of us, it's when we were talking before, playing kitchen detective and, trying to recreate our family recipes, that's what Barbara's done. So let's welcome Barbara. Barbara, are you there?
Yes. Hi. Thank you.
You're welcome. Absolutely. What a cool book and so many memories that you've put in it. So tell us a little bit about, why you wrote your book and what it's done to help your family.
Well, I decided to write my book because when my mother was diagnosed in December of 2005, it was actually around Christmas time. It was Christmas Eve. We were preparing for the annual 7-course fish dinner, which is in my book. And it's a meal that my mother has prepared for at least 50 years and that her mother prepared and her grandmother did. So it's very traditional 7-course fish meal. And she was really starting to forget what ingredients to put in, a lot of confusion going on in the kitchen. And my sister and I really kind of pitched in and was starting to help out. And following that spring, my father, thought she really needed to be tested. And when she was diagnosed, I realized I better start getting these recipes written down because they could easily be lost. She is the primary chef in the family, and I didn't know how to make a lot of the recipes. So I sat down with her as much as I could. She's in New York and I'm in Florida, but they did come down every winter for the last couple of years. And I would sit with her and get them written down as much as I could. And what she couldn't remember, I asked relatives and my sister helped me with. So
you
kind
know,
of an evolution.
I remember when my grandma started not to be able to, I was even my mom kind of getting too tired to make us big dinners anymore. And we were like, oh gosh, we better start learning how to do that. So I think this really resonates with probably so many of us, right?
I was going to say, Barbara, this is Marcia. It reminds me of my grandmother because she basically cooked by touch. She didn't use.
Same with
so
my.
So she made the most phenomenal white fudge, and I still to this day will not eat anybody else's because it's too sweet, but hers for some reason wasn't. It was Definity fudge. Mm-hmm. And when I asked her how to make it, she says, oh, you don't want that silly recipe. And I said, absolutely do. But I had to stand next to her and she'd take her hand and put it in the flour thing and start. I go, no, I gotta measure that. And I'd have to put it in a bowl and measure it. And it took us 3 or 4 times making it because it would get her all confused. So I can't even imagine
they bake or cook intuitively.
Right. So I can't imagine if someone has already forgotten something and then trying to get these recipes out of them.
Right. Well, I had to test all of the recipes before they were written. Writing a cookbook is very different than, just doing some family cooking together.
Right.
So, it was a lot of work, but I'm really glad I did it. And I tried to include anecdotal information on as many recipes as I could remember, that, stories around them and everything that really just were so heartwarming.
And now, what are your favorite recipes that you pulled out? I mean, were they things that you had, a lot of the recipes are Italian recipes, correct?
Right. Oh, yeah, they're all my mother's Italian recipes. It's appetizers, soups, pastas, salads, her special sauce, her saucy secrets on how to make it. Nice tomato sauce. You have to cook it for 4 hours on the Saturday before you serve on Sunday. And all of the holiday specialties, including desserts, which she was not a baker, but our relatives always baked, amazing Christmas desserts. So those are all in there, too.
It's interesting because my oldest daughter started recreating a lot of mine and my grandmother's and my mom's recipes, and then now my younger daughter. And it's interesting how they do a little twist on it. But each one, it's like, no, it's not the same. And you're really going after that exact taste. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting how food can trigger your memories.
Well, and one of my friends makes matzo ball soup for Hanukkah. And I'd say, can you tell me how to do that? She goes, I can't because it's the pan. It was my grandmother's pan, and it has some kind of flavor, and it will never turn out the same.
Well, right, I was actually going to say this, but about the matzo balls. My aunt used to make these huge, fluffy, soft, and that was the whole thing. The softer they were, the bigger they were, the better they were. And then I remember somebody else turning around and saying, well, they grew up with really little hard matzo balls, and they didn't think that the big soft ones were good. They were bad, you know?
We have the same conversation around meatballs. Whose are sweeter? Whose are smaller? Whose are harder? Whose are bigger? My grandmother Magra was always too hard, my mother said. She made her softer.
And so I think each generation changes something a little bit, but it's where you were in your life that you remember each thing.
Hi, Barbara. This is Karen, the nutritionist. I was wondering, you know, have you noticed difference of like the food quality in the recipes? Maybe you weren't able to replicate it perfectly because the tomatoes that your mother used were a different variety, or they, you know, just, you know.
Well, actually, the question is did your mom use a lot of fresh, or were they more canned?
You know, they used canned tomatoes in those days. I mean, the 1950s, 60s, 70s. I mean, I think a combination in the summer, definitely more fresh, but in the winter, definitely canned.
Right.
So, you know, depending.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you, I'm a really good chef, I mean, and I
do make great
tomato sauce, but the key is the canned tomato. Even if you use a canned tomato,
but it's the right can.
Yes.
It's the right
kind. And
there's
an Italian brand. I don't even know what it's called, but it's white. It's got a white cover with red. It's only sold, now they sell it at Vaughn's, but it was only sold at Whole Foods.
It
makes the biggest difference in your tomato sauce. I don't know what it was.
But Karen, you know, you were asking about the difference. Well, I come from South Africa, and I've been cooking since I was 15. And you come here, and the flour's different. Mm-hmm. The sugar's different. You have to cook by touch. You cannot just take the recipe because the recipes don't always come out properly.
Don't translate.
Right.
Especially baking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know what's interesting is, you know, I don't know if you did this with your mom or you probably had to write it, but my grandmother wrote it, and she wrote a pinch. Like,
right.
You know?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, my mother did that. Like, for Parmesan, just throw a pinch, and I'm like, Mom, now you need to say.
Yeah, what is a pinch, you know?
Right.
But no,
two teaspoons, three teaspoons, exactly.
Right, well,
so,
I think.
You know, I'm sure they're not exactly how my mother made them, but they're close enough. My mother made them with love. That was the whole big factor and ingredient that you put in that, you know, made them taste even better. And I have that, like the chicken soup. I talk about how she made that when we weren't feeling well. And, you know, I said, is it the soup or the love that was in the soup that made us better, right?
I love it. And, you know, I mean, really, that's what it's all about is when you're enjoying it. I mean, it really goes back to what we were just saying is if you're doing it out of love that you're making, you know, have you ever made a meal and you're not interested in making it and nobody's like, you know, you're too busy? It's hard to cook. But when you're so, you know, you're enjoying each.
You really enjoy the process.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I just
my mother worked full time, too, and yet she always had a fresh meal every night for dinner. But Sunday was really the big, you know, dinner that she prepared.
That's the dinner that
sauce on Saturday.
Yeah, I think.
But she cooked every night. None of this fast food stuff ever. Maybe on a Friday night we would order a pizza. That was about it.
That's
wow.
me.
I just want to remind anybody that's just tuning in right now that you are listening to The Kim Pagano Show. And we're talking with Barbara Magro, and her book is Recipes to Remember. And her mom, unfortunately suffered a devastating effect of Alzheimer's, and you've actually recreated your family recipes. So let me ask you, how hard was that?
It was difficult.
Yeah.
Which part? Learning the diagnosis or writing the recipes?
Both.
They were both hard.
Both, yeah.
Yeah, and well, when I first heard it, I actually was in denial. Most of my family was like, no, she's just getting old. You know, she's starting to forget. It's old age. But when my father went and took her for the test and it was confirmed, I mean, I have to say, I really wept for the loss of, this feisty, outspoken mother that always had an opinion about everything, very articulate, and that she was, you know, starting to fade. And I knew the upcoming path was going to be very long and windy and full of uncertainty.
Right.
And so it was a very sad time for all of us. And as far as the food goes, you know, cooking and dining together is the heart of the family, and when this begins to decline, it affects everyone. And since all of the kids were gone, it was my father who was affected by it the most. And then, of course, holidays, all of us.
But what a gift you have now.
It's been a sad, slow, long process.
And unfortunately, in such terribleness, you also, or fortunately, you were able to have a gift, not only for your family, to have something to remember your mom
I'm
by.
I'm so grateful I got it published before she passed away.
Well,
you know,
and for her.
I'm 85 years old.
And even though she may not have known who anybody was or known what she, you know, what a gift for her.
But Barbara,
to leave something for her.
I thought this was really interesting.
She enjoyed it, you know. She definitely enjoyed it, especially the early days. And also this past winter when they were here, the last day that they were leaving to go back to New York, WPLG, local TV Miami, came to my house and taped us cooking and did a segment on the book and on Alzheimer's. So the book is a fundraiser for the South Florida chapter of Alzheimer's.
That's what I want to say.
So I got to be on TV with my mother, and she looked beautiful, and I feel like so good and so complete with her.
That's so great. And yeah. I loved, you know, one of the things that you mentioned is, you know, you told her, hey, you might want to check out this cookbook, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so she was looking.
Oh, I mean, I used to tell her because, you know, over the years, so it's a six-year process, and we would see each other for 3 months in the winter, and then during the year I would fly up there, and I would always bring the next stage of what I was at with the book, and she would always be like, wow, you're writing a book about me? Yes, Mom, it's about you. Oh, how nice. Then I'd see her again, and I'd tell her again, same reaction. So she never remembered from time to time. But when I showed it to her, and I showed her picture, we have a picture in there when she graduated from college. She's like, oh, that's me. I'm like, yes, it's you.
Right.
And when she was in her normal mind many, many years ago, she used to always tell me, you should write a book. You should write a book.
I love
it. And here it is. But who knows? Who knew it was going to come around this way? Because the first part is autobiography. It's basically the story of my life growing up in New York and the path that I took up until when she was diagnosed, realizing that I didn't, you know how to cook her recipes and I better get them down. And then the second part are all the recipes. And then the third part is called Living with Memory Loss of a Loved One. And it talks about what my father has gone through as a caretaker and all the decisions he's had to make and where she's at with the disease. And then it lists all the facts on Alzheimer's in our country and then, you know, talks that it's a fundraiser for the Alzheimer's Association.
I think it's great what you've done. And, you know, so what would you suggest for my listeners and for all of us, you know, to make sure that, you know, I mean, you really got to start young and really enjoy and start writing those family. I mean, those are golden gifts, I call them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, get them down on on little index cards. I have a lot of my mother's recipes on index cards. When she would come and visit with me, she would leave me a few, and I, you know, collected them that way.
Right.
And the other thing.
You know, do it as you go along.
Both of my parents are gone and died fairly close to each other, and I got to say, the one thing I always tell my friends that still have family alive, there are questions in your mind that you want to ask that you just forget to ask or you avoid asking or you don't think it's that important. It is important because when they are gone, there is no asking. And
right. And
you know, there's some things you lose. So please take time and spend that time with your family members and ask them the things you've always wanted to know, whether it's the history of your family or,
oh, yeah, and if you
know,
have an iPad, record them. This
right.
is a friend of mine told me. His mother passed away in February. He's been videotaping her for the last few years. He played this whole videotape at the funeral. So the next time I was in New York, I videotaped my mother, my father. I asked them questions.
Wow,
I
you know.
My mother, you know.
And, you know, I've suggested that for some, my husband's aunt that had passed away, I suggest that to her kids. But we kind of forget those things, you know, sometimes.
Well, we all think we have longer than we have.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, I make my mother laugh. It's very funny, very funny.
Barbara, share with us some of the recipes, you know, a few recipes that you would like to share.
Well, my favorite in terms of pasta, I'm sure we all love pasta, is linguine with clams.
My favorite. Okay.
Friday night specialty. Because, you know, when I was raised Catholic, so on Friday nights we never ate meat when I was growing up. And
well, that's the reason for the fish night before Christmas, too.
Fresh clams in the summer, you can use canned clams in the winter. So it's very easy. You just, you know, you parboil water, obviously, with salt in it. You put garlic and olive oil in a pan. You empty 2 dozen either little neck fresh clams or 2 8-ounce cans of chopped clams into the garlic sauteing in the olive oil. And you also use 1 bottle of the Doxy clam juice so that the clams are moist. And then you boil your pasta, you mix it all together, you throw in some fresh parsley, black pepper, and you put in butter at the end because that makes it nice and, you know, not sticky.
And a pinch
moist.
Of Parmesan?
And that's it. And a little Parmesan if you want, but you know.
Yeah, there you go. Wow. And so
they always say when you have white sauce, you're not supposed to use Parmesan. My grandfather, my mother's father, used to get so mad at us if we would put Parmesan cheese on our white pasta.
Isn't that funny? Like it's they
on the
take
red sauce, it's okay. I mean, he would get really mad.
Like
at
they're
us.
Taking it personal. I know because my husband's family is all Italian. And they are personal about their, although my mom and my grandmother are the same way, you know. I mean, you don't need any more of that. You know, it's like, right?
Yeah. It's like when I cook and somebody salts their food before they taste it, it's very insulting to me. Because I did take a lot of time and precious, I did taste the food and make sure it was perfectly seasoned. So when you salt it before you even taste it, it drives me nuts.
And now for me, because I don't use a lot of salt, right? Is I'm like, you might want to salt it, you know?
Well, they may want to, but at least taste it first.
There you go. I like it. What, now, do you have, you said appetizers on there. What are some of the appetizers? Give us one appetizer.
Well, we always did antipasto when there was a big holiday, of course, but she also has bruschetta and these little mozzarella balls that we would wrap in prosciutto. Those were always good. Mm. And then my grandmother, Eloise, used to make chicken livers. Well, of course, my mother made those too. Mm.
I love chicken. Yeah. Oh, really? See? Okay.
My
grandmother lived in a two-bedroom apartment in the Bronx, and we would come up the hallway, and we could smell the aroma of the chicken livers frying in the pan as we were in the hallway.
Unbelievable.
You'd open the door, you know, they would be timed perfectly. We'd sit down. We'd have them with crackers. Delicious.
So do you have a recipe for that?
Uh-huh. Certainly do.
See, that's cultural, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It's just
because you Italians and then the other two here are Jewish and they all like chicken livers. I myself don't eat anything that's supposed to filter junk out of your blood. That's my theory.
No, okay.
I like it.
See, once or twice a year, it's not going to kill you and it's delicious. That's
there
right.
You go. It's kind of like a chopped liver. Right?
Right.
I mean, you take
like
the bread
like
and you...
It's pate in French food, right?
There you go.
Don't
so
eat that either.
Six chicken livers, a tablespoon of olive oil, a medium onion that you slice, and then some flatbread crackers. And you just...
You guys like caviar too, right?
Small cube to heat the olive in olive oil in a frying pan. You saute the onions in the olive oil. And keep stirring until they're translucent. And then you put the chicken livers chopped with the onions. Stir until they're thoroughly cooked. And you serve immediately on crackers warm. So...
Wow.
Delicious.
You know, I do want to tell my listeners, give the name of your book again.
It's Recipes to Remember.
Where do we find it?
Right. You can get it on Amazon, barnesandnobles.com. It's all print on demand, so it's digital. You buy it digitally. Or you can go to my website, which is recipestoremember.net, and purchase it there, and you'll have it within 5 days.
Okay. So it's only digital?
Right. It's print on demand. I self-publish.
Got it.
You know, the 21st century of publishing.
I like it. Okay, I can't wait to...
Books are Random House for me.
Yeah, I can't wait to get my copy. I just think that you have made a treasure. And
it's a great gift.
Yeah.
So many people can relate to this, either through the recipes, the Alzheimer's, or just, you know, nostalgia of family.
Definitely.
You know, this is about the love of a mother, a very important love in life.
Right. And now, did the rest of your family help you make this?
Well, I mean, I definitely wrote it. They helped me with recipes. That was it. Mm-hmm. And they helped me with photos because I did have to go. In my first part, my epicurean journey, I used old photos, and I asked a lot of relatives to give me photos of the family eating through the years. So I got a lot in my parents' personal photo album, but I did get some from other relatives, and they're quite funny.
I'm curious, was there any recipes that your mom didn't quite remember and you had to fill in somehow?
Well, there probably were a lot, but my sister knew them all, so I didn't have to, you know, fudge on any of them, really. My sister cooks a lot of these foods now for my father. She has stepped in.
Your sister?
She's lived near my parents the whole life. I mean, I'm the traveler. That's why I wrote my Epicurean Journey. I talk about all my travels. I'm the gypsy in the family. I'm like, you know, the prodigal son. I was gone for 25 years. I mean, I'll come back for Christmas, but I moved back to New York in 1999. So,
and that's interesting because you would think that your sister, who was in there, and you know, now she's the one who cooks for them, right?
No one had this idea. I'm the creative one.
Okay.
Who takes action?
Okay, that sounds
good.
You
have to take action. It was, you know. It was a long process. A lot of them got tired of hearing about it. Like, they didn't think I was going to actually
ever
do it and finish it, and I did.
Wow. Well, I love it. I think it's an amazing idea. And I think that, you know,
anyone could do it. Anyone could do it.
Right. And I think you could even do it as a family, you know, I mean, because, you know, there's different things and different tastes that everybody likes.
You know, one of the things my sister
and I did have family contribute recipes, as I was saying, like all of the dessert recipes are all contributed from various relatives. So it definitely was a project where I enrolled a lot of family members, and it, you know, brought me closer to a lot of people that I hadn't really been connected to because I was gone for 25 years.
My sister-in-law did this for her family and our family. She took all of our family recipes, and the fun thing that she did was she put them in notebooks and put 5 copies of each recipe in the notebook. So when you took that recipe to somebody's house and they asked you for the recipe, you just whipped it out and handed it to them. I thought that was a great idea.
Yeah, that is a good idea. Very
okay,
good.
Well, perfect. Well, thank you so much, Barbara, for sharing your journey and your recipes. And, you know, again, Barbara Magro, Recipes to Remember, and thank you so much for sharing.
Right, and recipes2remember.net is my website where you can order it.
You got it. We're going to take a really quick break, and you are listening to the Kim Pagano Show. I do want to give away 2 sets of tickets right now to the Young Artists Ensemble, which is in Caneo Valley Premier Youth Theater Company, and they're presenting The King and I, and that is Friday and Saturdays at 7:30, and Saturdays and Sundays at 2 p.m., and that it starts November 2nd through the 18th. And right now, it's I think it's going to be really fun. So give me a call right now. There's 2 sets of tickets, 2 each, and 805-419-0008. And it's 805-419-0008. You're listening to The Kim Pagano Show. We'll be right back.
If you're a business owner or looking to be one, put Littlefoot Construction on the top of your list. Littlefoot Construction specializes in restaurant remodels, tenant improvements, office remodels. Call Littlefoot Construction with all your commercial and industrial needs. Littlefoot Construction works with big or small businesses, or even if it's a dream, Littlefoot Construction will make your vision come true. Call Littlefoot Construction at 805-491-2759. That's 805-491-2759 for all your construction needs.
I'm a lifelong Ventura County resident, and I hate to admit it, but I'm guilty of something, and I'm guilty of being what you call a hair jumper. And what that means is that I'm not really loyal to any one particular barber, stylist, or hair cutter, and that also means my hair doesn't always look as good or as great as it could. Until that is, I met Kim Pagano, the one and only hair therapist of Westlake Village. Now, I wasn't a believer until I got up from her chair and saw the magic she did on this head of hair, and I know she's going to do the same for you. So give her a call, 818-612-0832. That's 818-612-0832. She's going to change your life. She's going to change the life of your hair, and she's going to end your days as a hair jumper. Give Kim Pagano, the hair therapist of Westlake Village, a call. It's 818-612-0832.
It's showtime.
Now, back to the Kim Pagano Show on News Talk 1520
KVTA.
Welcome back, everyone, and I thank you so much for being here on this amazing Saturday. And we are talking about different aspects of food and how to nourish your mind, your body, your soul. Also, how foods trigger different memories. And we've talked to an array of different people about different journeys, and you know, I'm just really excited. Our next guest right now is Tracy McCormick, and her book, which I think is just coming out. I'm not sure it's even out yet, but Living a Real Food Life. And I'm excited to have her on in our studio. We have Karen, and we have Karen Roth, who is a nutritionist, a holistic nutritionist. We have Sharon Savidson, and we've got Marsha Hively. And I am so glad that you are here with us. Mi, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
Well, how are you?
Good. Excited to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much. So tell us a little bit about your journey and why you wrote your book.
Well, I was a person who did not cook, did not know how to cook, and wasn't interested in cooking anything other than processed food. So if it came out of a box and it had a pretty picture, then that's what I bought.
Macaroni and cheese then, right?
Yeah. And I just shopped by the pictures.
I love it. Now, this is the extreme of the other end, you know? I mean, which it's kind of interesting. We've talked to different, you know, different women and different men. You know, Karen's husband was on, too, about what food means so many different things to us. So what happened then?
Well, what happened is, over the period of about 10 years, I started to suffer low-grade digestive distress. And I call it low-grade because it just became something I was accustomed to, and it was like a low-grade fever. It was always there, and every time I ate, I had a stomach ache, and I had discomfort. And then eventually it just seemed to get worse and worse, and within 10 years, after 10 years of going to doctors and trying to figure out what it was and thinking it was irritable bowel and it was all these things, we couldn't really, they couldn't figure it out. But I began to, my health started to deteriorate because I couldn't eat. And then after 10 years, I couldn't eat at all, and I weighed about 90 pounds, and I was in chronic severe pain 95% of the time. And I was living in the Mexican jungle and with my husband, and I got really sick, and I had a bowel obstruction.
Nice. Okay. Yeah.
Wow.
So then I came back to the United States and went to doctors and found out that I had a hole the total circumference of my small intestine in my ilium. And they
leaky
thought
gut.
It was either small intestinal cancer or aggressive Crohn's disease. But if it was aggressive Crohn's, they had thought it had already turned into intestinal cancer.
Wow. And so did you have intestinal cancer?
Well, I had the final, for them to do the final biopsy, they wanted me to start taking prednisone and inflammation fighters. And as I lined up the 24 pills I was going to start to take, I heard a voice, and the voice said, "What's in it?" An internal voice. And I knew that I couldn't swallow water, and I would never be able to swallow these 24 pills. And so I became my own researcher and couldn't find the answer to what was actually in the cocktail that was prescribed to me. But along the way, I discovered so many side effects that I knew I would never survive because I was already on intravenous iron transfusions, and I was so weak I could barely stand.
You know, we have Karen in here, and Karen is a holistic nutritionist. Do you have any comments on this?
Boy, it sounds like such a horrible thing to go through. And how long did it take for them to finally get a diagnosis from you?
It took 10 years, and their diagnosis was never set because they wanted to do the double balloon procedure, which is a really invasive procedure. You go, you know, you enter deep into the small intestine, and then you blow it up, and then you take a biopsy. But right after I began my quest to ask questions, I connected with a woman who is the head of the Shaw Wellness Center in Spain's digestive disorders department, and she happened to live in Nashville, Tennessee, where I also live, and she was teaching people to cook foods that healed the gut. And I went to one of her classes, and within 3 weeks I was off the sofa, and within 6 weeks I was eating plates of food.
Now, what do you think was in your diet that caused this? Do you think
it was many things. You know, first of all, I ate all processed foods. I ate a typical American diet, high in sugar. I ate a lot of dairy. I had had a dairy allergy from the time I was a small child. And like most parents, they thought I seemed to outgrow it. And so cheese and milk became something for me to eat. And my body, while it was fighting that, my immune system was fighting the dairy that I was eating. It was weakening my immune system. And then I ate a ton of sugar, so I probably got a really strong, potent digestive bacteria like most people are susceptible to now, some type of E. coli or salmonella, because I remembered having food poisoning a few times.
Me, were you in a depression?
In a depression?
Yeah, I mean, because it sounds like, I mean, most of us know if we're eating healthy or not eating healthy, right? I mean,
well, I know. I mean, I've always been a really thin and person and active, and I was eating. I was eating
on the go,
even organic food in a box. I just wasn't eating any fresh food. I mean, I never ate kale. I never ate greens. I never ate sea vegetables.
Okay.
I never ate miso.
So, okay, so this is what has brought you to this path in this and your lifestyle now, your lifestyle change, correct?
Oh, my life completely changed.
Okay, so let's talk about where you are now and your book, Living a Real Food Life, right?
Right.
And I just want to remind anybody that's just tuning in right now that you are listening to The Kim Pagano Show. We're talking to me, Tracy McCormick. And so what does that mean to you? What does it mean to live a real food life?
Well, I soon found that the problem is that we're not really cooking real food. So it wasn't that I was eating at McDonald's every day. I wasn't cooking every day. I wasn't cooking fresh food, nothing out of a box, nothing out of a jar, and nothing out of a can.
It's more like assembly is what you'd say you're doing. You're assembling food and not actually preparing or cooking food.
Assembling food is not cooking.
Okay,
so I changed my entire life. And in the morning, I'd get up and cook. You know, every day there's a fresh vegetable cooked. Every day I cooked grains that I soaked overnight. I added sea vegetables to my food. And I changed my cattle company. I have one of the largest privately owned cattle companies in the Mid-Atlantic. And we changed it from a conventional cattle ranch to a grass-fed farm. And then I changed, I grew 7 acres of biodynamic food. And I have my own mushroom farm as well.
Okay, so talk to us about how did you say that?
Biodynamic organic produce.
Yeah.
What that means is you basically treat the soil, not with chemicals, but with attention. I mean, there's a lot of different definitions of it, but biodynamic food means that we are constantly maintaining the health of our soil, both spiritually and physically. So we're mindful of our compost, we're mindful of everything that goes into the soil, what we've grown, what we grow around it, how it's developed, how it's cultivated, because that affects the nutrition profile of the food.
Is this interesting, ladies and gentlemen that have been listening? Everything we need to do in our life has to be mindful. I mean, it really,
really
just, it's like a full circle coming around from all of our guests that I've had on the show. You have to be... everything needs a purpose.
Well, I think it takes us back to being at the cause of life instead of at the effect of life.
Yeah.
We're so busy being at the effect that we are not taking control of what we do, what we say, how we behave, what we eat.
Yeah, and I think that is the key to living a real food life, is really forming a relationship with your food. Where does it come from? How is it grown? And what are you doing with it? And in which way are you eating it? So now I'm mindful of what I'm eating all of the time and how I eat it and how often I eat it and what's on my family table.
Me, what is a typical day in your life now?
A typical day in my life is I wake up at about 5:30 in the morning and I make breakfast.
What is breakfast?
Breakfast this morning was a soaked oat that I added in roasted pumpkin and raisins and cinnamon and nutmeg. And fresh coconut milk.
Okay, so oats. This is what I wanted to clarify with you, Karen. Is oats, is that gluten?
No, oats are typically gluten-free, but the problem arises is that they're usually contaminated because they are in the same facility of other grains that contain gluten. So the government, I forget who did it, did a study on different brands of oats, and something like 80% of them all had gluten in it.
So like the old-fashioned oatmeal.
You got to, if you're looking for gluten-free oats, you have to get the gluten-free. It has to say gluten-free.
Right, I get that.
And I'm gluten-free. I'm totally gluten-free.
Oh, you are.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
So was that one of your problems, do you think?
Oh, 100%. And that's because of what's going on with our wheat in this country. I mean, I'm a farmer, come from a big family of farmers, married into a massive farming family. And what's happened with our wheat is one of the things is that we have been developing a hardier wheat because of the way that you can grow it in quantity and not quality, and that quantity is one of the roughest grains to digest, and then it's topped with pesticides. So it really is the most abrasive thing for the digestive tract to digest is the wheat that we're eating. So I do avoid wheat, and that has been mighty helpful.
I'm curious about something. We live in an agricultural valley. Here in Ventura, and we live in Santa Rosa Valley, Kim and I do, that is an agricultural valley. And how did your family, coming from a farming family react when you said, we're going to change the way you've done things for God knows how many years?
Well, the irony is that the family that I married into is probably one of the head. They were really, they started the first chain of grocery stores in the United States. So they really set the house for processed food. So when we changed it and I changed the way I cooked, you know, there was a lot of pushback at us. There was a lot of pushback at me. You know, a lot of people said, well, what are you doing? That's weird. What are you talking about? Why are you cooking that? That's weird. And the truth is, I just bring them back that this is actually an ancestral way of eating. And this is the way that the family ate 100 years ago.
So true. We forget that. It's kind of like
new age.
Right. When you hear, you know, cook like your grandma used to, you know.
That's what I do.
Yeah. I think that's so important. Now, you talk about a community kitchen. What is a community kitchen?
So once I was well enough, it was like this huge light bulb went off over top of my head. And I thought, oh, my gosh. I've got to tell everybody that you don't have to live with chronic disease, because I'm completely well now. Never took a pill.
Thank God.
And that ulceration is gone, and every single, you know, I've had every ounce of blood work run to see my nutritional profile and how will I absorb. And I mean, my hormones are great, my focus, my energy. I don't drink coffee at 3 p.m. You know, I'm like a go machine.
Really?
And so I wanted to tell the world that you could get well with food.
I love your message. I love it.
Thanks. So I went into Nashville. You know, I live in the South, and I created something in a North Nashville neighborhood, which is predominantly African American, and it was a food desert, meaning there's no food, fresh food available within 10 miles. And I went into a church there, and I started cooking for 50 people a night for no more than $40, all fresh food.
Wow.
And we worked with the whole, I worked with the entire congregation to get them cooking. And it had a profound effect on the community there. And then I moved the community kitchen to Music Row in Nashville. And now I have 150 people when I cook that show up. And we cook full on meals together. I use butane burners and card tables. And I show them that you don't need a large kitchen. You just need fresh food, and you need to know what to do with it.
How many times a week do you do that?
Well, I'm now in Malibu, and I do this here in Los Angeles,
too. Oh, you do? I want to come to one of the...
Yeah, I do them here. I host them here.
Okay.
And in Nashville, I do them about every other week. And right now, it's about once a month. So I will be returning to Nashville and cooking November 17th. I'll be cooking here in Malibu in January. Start again.
All right, please let me know when that is. Now, what do you cook when you cook in a community kitchen?
First of all, I like to push people to try new things. Everybody knows how to cook chicken and a piece of steak. So I go for all of the vegetables that most people have forgotten about because they were ancestral. They're what we used to eat.
And what is that?
So this summer I made patty pan squash. Mm. Right now I'm cooking a lot of kabocha squash because squash, you know, it helps it supports our pancreas and it's good. It's a great preventative of diabetes, something that I'm always thinking about, and the autoimmune diseases with people. So right now I'm into kabocha squash, any kind of squash and pumpkin, I'm cooking it.
I mean, that's seasonal, and as far as this is the season to eat that kind of food.
That's what I'm eating right now.
Are you mindful of the season that
it's
grown?
Incredibly, 100%.
Yeah, we've heard that before, haven't we, a lot.
Well, your body needs it. You know, you think about your intestines, and they're the root of, in my opinion, they're the root of our wellness. They're our human root. And so they really need to be supported with the seasons. And so right now I think my root needs support before going into the winter, so I'm eating root vegetables, and I'm eating seasonally, and then I shift. And I don't eat or buy anything that's out of season, and that's to support my health.
That's so great.
You know, it's funny because people think I'm strange. When I go to the market or the vegetable market or whatever, I smell the food. If you can't smell it, it isn't fresh. Not fresh, and it's not seasonal, like peaches. Peaches smell when you're supposed to eat them.
Yeah, totally. I'm a sniffer. Even when I cook, I sniff.
I actually do that, too. Now, okay, let's go back to this patty pan squash.
Mm-hmm.
I have never heard of patty pan.
Exactly. But they also call it cathead squash.
Cathead, okay.
And it is a really mild, and it's a summer squash.
Okay, so what does it look like? Where do you get it?
It's green, and it can be like it's white with a hue of green. And you get it, well, you would get it seasonally because it's not grown now. And so usually you can find things like that at farmer's market, and that's what I do. I really encourage people to shop farmer's market because that really helps keep you in season with food.
Exactly.
And you know if you're shopping with what's out and what's coming out, then your body is in sync, and it just makes it super easy, and plus it supports, you know, local farmers and economy.
Neither is a Sharon. It's funny. And a lot of the names are different in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But patty pan squash to me is a little squash, and it looks like kind of like a flower, like a tiny little pumpkin, but a flat pumpkin. And they come in yellow and green.
Yes, but they're not really that small because they can be as big as a cat head.
Oh,
that's
really?
That's why we call them cat heads. But, you know, all over they grow them differently.
Oh, so it's the same thing?
But it's super mild. The flavor is in, it's just a beautiful squash because it has very few seeds, and you can eat the skin because the skin is
right.
really fine.
Really? So how do you prepare it?
I just cook it, steam it, and make a soup with it. Garlic, onions, miso. And that's the other thing I do. I cook with a lot of miso, and I use soy-free miso, which is chickpea-based.
Soy-free miso.
Yeah, and I do. And instead of taking the probiotics that I was told to take by so many people, I eat my probiotics. So I eat fermented foods, and that helps not have, that helps you skip that whole digestive distress that you go through when you introduce a high population of a probiotic.
No.
So instead, it's a gradual process where you're eating your probiotic. So I eat kimchi, I eat homemade sauerkraut, I eat natto, I eat miso about four times a week mixed into different types of soups and sauces.
Me, can I ask you something? You said that your miso is chickpea-based, not soy. What about your natto?
My natto is soy, but I pay attention to the amount of soy that's going into my body because I also, you know, when your intestines don't work for so long, your liver suffers, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so the liver flushes the estrogen, and I became estrogen dominant because, of course, my liver couldn't handle anything.
Yeah.
And so in balancing my estrogen levels and my hormone levels, I'm mindful of how much soy and then, of course, you know, the phthalates and all the other things that I'm exposed to. But a little bit of natto. Natto really helped in the beginning, by the way.
Okay, what is natto? Sorry to have to ask that.
Soybean. It tastes like funky, stinky cheese.
Where do we get this?
You can get that in an Asian market, or you can order it online at Natural Food Import. And they have a lot of, it's a Japanese food, but you eat it with your food.
It is stinky. How do you get around that? I don't know that I could do it.
In the craziest way, I love blue cheese.
I like
blue
cheese.
I do too. I love blue cheese.
So I just thought of it as my blue cheese, and I mixed it in, and I kind of have this weird loving thing with natto. And, you know, in really great Japanese restaurants, they make natto rolls and umeboshi plums. That's part of my medicine too. And that's a fermented plum that fights acid.
So what do you say that the natto does for you?
The natto is a digestive aid. So, you know, most countries and ancestral countries are observant of when they're eating, how well they're digesting. So they eat kimchi, they eat sauerkraut, they use horseradish to help, you know, when you eat sushi, kills parasites.
Right. Me, you talked about, I guess, homemade sauerkraut. Okay. How do you do that?
That's just a simple little recipe, and you can Google it, and I think I have it on my site. But you're just going to use your vinegars, and you put it in a jar, and you let it sit, and that's it.
And
leave it on your counter.
And it's good,
and it lasts for, you know, it'll last for 6 weeks in your refrigerator if you can keep it that long, because everybody loves it.
And that's really good for you?
Well, when I was at my weakest in digestion, or if I ever get irritated, because my intestines are always going to sort of be my little Achilles heel. I'll always take care of them. Well, I will even the better, you know, as well as I feel.
So you're saying if someone has irritable bowel, or they should eat that?
Well, if people have irritable bowel, they should pay attention, because if your bowel is irritated, and if you are having any kind of digestive distress, it's a heads up, because it's a precursor. It's saying your root is not functioning and is not supported. So yes, if you have any type of digestive distress, you want to eat a little bit of fermented foods with your food. So that's just a teaspoon on your plate when you eat.
It's like a condiment.
Yeah, like a condiment. It's a digestive aid. And you want to eat your digestive aid so that, you know, the food breaks down in the stomach and it makes it to the small intestines, and that's where it's absorbed. And if the food hasn't broken down in the stomach, by the time it gets to the small intestines, you're not going to absorb your nutrition, and you're going to have a lot of digestive distress. So I also tell people, know thy intestines. Really understand how the body works.
So my daughter in first grade got a parasite, a very bad parasite. She got very, very ill. And we ended up, it took us almost a year and a half to get rid of it, and we did get rid of the parasite. But she has digestive issues, and she has to be very careful. For children that, you know, she's 17 now, so you can she'll get over some of this. But for children that have digestive problems, what's the best way to start introducing these foods?
The best way is to, you just do it. I mean, I have two little girls. My mother, by the way, had Crohn's disease and died at age 39. Raising my children, I'm really mindful of what I'm feeding them. And it's a gradual process. You just gradually change the food. And so what I do is I implemented whole grains that were soaked overnight with kombu seaweed and softened, and gradually adding in fiber food. You know, I was told I could never eat fiber. Well, if you don't eat fiber, you'll never repair the muscle. And so now that's not true. It's sort of this backwards way of looking at it. So you cook things softer. You cook your vegetables, and you cook them soft. And then that's the other argument that people make is, well, you can't get well if you're cooking your food.
Me, what do you think about kombucha and kefir?
Well, I think the kombucha is, it's fermented, and I think it's great. It's actually something I avoided because on a wellness diet for cancer or autoimmune disease, I'm mindful of the amount of yeast. And so the only yeasted foods that I put in my body were maitake mushrooms that actually are yeast-free, and I was careful with the shiitake. So I didn't do the kombucha, and I know that a lot of people, you know, are big fans of it, but for me, it wasn't part of my wellness.
What is kombucha? I don't know.
It's a mushroom, and then the mushroom grows, and then the water that comes off of it, they make a tea out of it. And it's, you know, it's fermented from sugar like most fermented.
Right. And can you just buy the tea?
You can buy the tea.
Is that good for you?
You know, I'm certain it's good for you. It hasn't been part of my wellness.
Okay.
My regimen. I mean, my regimen has just been really simple, real foods and being mindful of my digestive tract and how I support it.
So, Mi, how do you cook every day and manage to eat real good food?
I just do it. I get up in the morning and I make breakfast, and then if I haven't, I call them foundation foods. So yesterday I made a kale grass-fed beef stew.
Oh, I love kale.
With miso and hijiki seaweed in it. And a gluten-free cornbread. So there's a leftover of that at home. So it's a foundation. Like one day you cook a lot, and then the next day you just have to throw in something else to go with it. And then the next day you cook a lot, and then the following day it's just add a fresh steamed vegetable. So I'm constantly, it's foundation. And the more that you cook like this, the more organized your life is. And you never come home at 5 o'clock, and I have two small children, and I work full-time. I never come home at 5 o'clock and go, oh, my gosh, what are we going to eat?
Okay.
So I want to ask you a question. So when you're changing your life that dramatically, mm-hmm. I would assume since you had such a quick change, you changed it all at once. But for people, I mean, should you add things slowly or subtract things slowly?
I think the thing is to not think about what you're not going to be eating, and start thinking about the new things that you're going to be eating. Because I really eat from way larger of a variety of food than I ever ate before in my life. And so, yes, for certain people, for certain illnesses, start becoming mindful of what you're eating. How often are you putting sugar in your mouth? How often are you grabbing that Diet Coke, or are you putting cheese on your plate or butter on your food? You know, so it's a mindfulness, because once your mind is right, your table's right. And knowing that it's your choice, that you get to choose to eat this way, is really empowering.
You know, my last question, and I'm going to have you back. This is so interesting. I mean, I could talk for longer, and we only have a little bit left. But so what are three foods to incorporate into our diet?
It's the three power foods to move into your diet for certain are sea vegetables, leafy greens, and whole grains, low-carbohydrate whole grains, meaning millet and quinoa. Millet helps balance blood sugar. It's great for people for diabetics. And quinoa, which is a superfood from the spinach family, which is technically a seed. So I try to add fiber-packed foods in, leafy greens, and cook with the vegetables as many times as possible.
I got to tell you, I'm a good cook, but and I've had a bag of quinoa, and I just took it out of the thing. What am I going to do? What am I doing with it? Give me a recipe.
Okay, yeah. I make it recipes. Totally Peruvian style. So I put it in, I rinse it off. I put it in the skillet with olive oil, onions, garlic, and any kind of vegetables that you want to chop up and throw in there. Carrots are great in there. And then you cover it with water. And just like rice, so rice, you're going to have a cup of rice, 2 cups of water. So one of my cups of water for the quinoa, I dilute a little miso in there for flavor and for protein. And I cover it up, and you can add a little sea salt and pepper if you want. And then I top it with either lots of fresh cilantro in the end or parsley.
And I'd like to add there about the sea vegetables. One easy way you can incorporate that into your daily diet is using kombu. And kombu is a sea vegetable that looks like a piece of dried bacon, wouldn't you say, me?
Yeah, and you know, I add that in when I'm soaking my quinoa, and then it hydrates, and then I chop it, and it's part of the onions and the garlic.
And you get it in the vegetable section?
Oh, you get it in the Asian food section, and you can just ask them for the kombu seaweed.
And how long do you have to rinse it for?
The quinoa you just rinse off.
Wow.
And the kombu, you just want to hydrate it and then finely dice it and add it in with your garlic and onion.
Wow. Me, this has been a pleasure. I'm so glad that you have made your life different and that you're feeling amazing and that you've shared your journey with us. Where do we find you?
MeTracy.com, MeETRACY.com.
Okay, great. I definitely want to have you back, and I can't wait to hear your book. And when is it coming out?
The first week of January.
All right. Thank you so much, Me.
Thanks, y'all.
All right. Well, we are at the end of our show, and gosh, I mean, amazing. It was an amazing show. I don't know about all of you, but I've gotten so much out of it. I want to just go back, and Karen Roth, holistic nutritionist, give out your website so people can find you.
It's my name, Karen Roth, R-O-T-H, nutrition.com.
Sharon, I know you've got something coming up really quick. Just,
all right, Kim, if that stressed you out, I have a free tele-seminar coming up on the 30th of this month. It's an hour. It's a free call. So go onto my website, SharonSavidson.com, click on events, and you will get the access code to the seminar. If you cannot make it on that day, you will get sent the link for you to be able to access it.
Okay.
My number is 818-744-5859.
All right. Marcia, can't wait to hear all the great things that you're going to be doing.
I'm having fun here.
There you go. All right. And I want to thank all of you that you tuned in to the Kim Pagano Show. If you've missed any part of my show, you can always listen on my website, Kim Pagano Show, and download them there. Or you can download them on iTunes. And I want to thank you for being a part of our show. We always talk about anything that adds value to your life. And, of course, you know, also I want to give out your phone number if you would like to be a part of my show. Just call me at 805-419-0008. Of course, I end all of my shows with a mommy moment, and today's is do not give up. The beginning is always the hardest. With that, you have a great rest of your weekend, and next week I'll talk to you Saturdays from 2 to 4. You've been listening to The Kim Pagano Show.
I'm a lifelong Ventura County resident, and I hate to admit it, but I'm guilty of something, and I'm guilty of being what you call a hair jumper. And what that means is that I'm not really loyal to any one particular barber, stylist, or hair cutter, and that also means my hair doesn't always look as good or as great as it could. Until that is, I met Kim Pagano, the one and only hair therapist of Westlake Village. Now, I wasn't a believer until I got up from her chair and saw the magic she did on this head of hair, and I know she's going to do the same for you. So give her a call, 818-612-0832. That's 818-612-0832. She's going to change your life. She's going to change the life of your hair, and she's going to end your days as a hair jumper. Give Kim Pagano, the hair therapist of Westlake Village, a call. It's 818-612-0832.
If you're a business owner or looking to be one, put Littlefoot Construction on the top of your list. Littlefoot Construction specializes in restaurant remodels, tenant improvements, office remodels. Call Littlefoot Construction with all your commercial and industrial needs. Littlefoot Construction works with big or small businesses. Or even if it's a dream, Littlefoot Construction will make your vision come true. Call Littlefoot Construction at 805-491-2759. That's 805-491-2759 for all your construction needs.